In a world in which movies struggle to find plot, Alan Adams of The Main Edge breaks it down for you in Pass the Popcorn. Now on Downtown with Rich Kimball.
That is the truth. Let's all go to the lobby. Time to talk movies, Pass the Popcorn, and oh my goodness, he's back in studio. First time in forever. Alan Adams with us. Hello there, Mr. Adams.
Here I am. Hooray.
Oh, man. We've missed you. How you been?
I've been pretty well. It's been, you know, between the holiday break and then, I took a little bit of a vacation myself. So, it's been a little bit since we've been here.
You had a good Christmas, I trust.
I did. It was lovely. We went down to Cherryfield and spent it with my in-laws. It was just Sheridan and myself. Sheridan's parents and my sister joined us, which was really nice. And then New Year's was a little bittersweet because there was a stretch there where we were holding out hope that our annual New Year's Day celebration would be something that would be able to take place, but Omicron took care of that pretty easily. So,
which is sad for us because it's one of our absolute favorite events of the year.
Us too. Like it's very much a highlight of the. Well, I mean it's the social event of the season.
What is?
I think there's no disputing that. It was fine. It was fun. We had a very quiet New Year's, and we're just plugging away day by day.
There you go. Well, it's a brand new year. I'd like to think it's going to get better than the last one. But
well, I mean, you want to say it has to, but we said that last year.
Yeah.
And I mean, I suppose technically it's better, but I mean, you know, I'd prefer less, you know, incremental progress if at all possible.
I would like that, and I would prefer less death of people whose work I love.
Man, not to be crude about it. Like, I mean, we lost some very you had the conversation with Peter Bogdanovich, Betty White, Bob Saget, which was tragic.
That's the one that blew me away. I mean, 65 for God's sake.
I mean, he's and by all accounts, like, you know, I'm sure there's more to come, but by all accounts, it just kind of seems like something that just kind of happened.
Yeah,
which is. Which is terrifying in its own right.
Mm-hmm.
But at least the powers that be came and got Robert Durst today. So we got that. So, you know.
A bit of balance.
Yeah, you know, you'll take the wins where you can get them.
Exactly. Well, let's talk movies. I'm sure you've seen a whole bunch since last time we talked, but you got a couple you want to focus on today.
Yeah, we'll start with the ones that were sort of new this weekend. We'll get this one out of the way. I went to see a movie called The 355. It's an action movie directed by Simon Kinberg. Who's best known for directing some of the worst entries in the X-Men franchise. And it's an action movie, stars Jessica Chastain. And it's one of those things where it's like you look at the cast because you've got Jessica Chastain, Penelope Cruz is in this movie, Lupita Nyong'o, like just a stacked cast. And on the dude side, you've got Edgar Ramirez, Sebastian Stan is in this movie. Just a wonderful cast. And then they just throw them in this very generic blah sort of action movie. I'll give you the gist. There's a drug cartel. The cartel leader's son has invented some MacGuffin that basically controls all computers in a way that is, you know, science. It gets stolen by a drug agent who raids the compound. The agent tries to sell it. Brandi Chastain, CIA agent, Jessica Chastain, Brandi Chastain. that's a very different movie. Jessica Chastain and her partner, played by Sebastian Stan, have to, you know, they put together an operation to retrieve the device. But then, you know, there's a German agent played by Diane Kruger who gets into the mix. And then Penelope Cruz is the therapist who shows up to talk to Edgar Ramirez, who's the agent who took the thing. To sort of talk him through his business. And then it just gets all convoluted. Lupita Nyong'o is in there as a former MI6 agent who is a cybersecurity expert. And then there's a bunch of running around and shooting and general nonsense. Like it's really unfortunate because, again, like I said, it's a wonderful cast, but the movie's just, it's just not very good. It's funny. A friend of Sheridan's, her daughter, had been talking to her mom about really wanting to go see this particular movie. And she was holding out, and Sheridan's friend was like, have Alan tell me, like, what I should do about this. And my basic sort of one sentence situation was, if I'm going to risk the coronavirus to see a movie, this ain't it. and I feel like that is, you know, and judging by the turnout at my screening, it's not going to be a huge problem. Social distance and spacing will not be an issue in these theaters. Again, I wear a mask and the whole shebang, but you know, when there's only four other people in the movie theater, you feel pretty good about stuff. But yeah, so the 355, not a great experience.
Now I'm trying to envision what it would have been like with Brandy testing.
Right?
Heading soccer balls at people. Yeah. Might have been better.
Yeah, it couldn't have been worse.
There you go. All right, the other one is a movie that we've both seen, and I'm very curious to see what you think of The Tender Bar.
Yeah, The Tender Bar. It's based on a memoir by J.R. I want to say Roethlisberger. That's not right.
Is it Moehringer?
It's something like that. He's a noted journalist. He won the Pulitzer back in 2000. He wrote this memoir about his time growing up on Long Island. With his with a single mom, and you know, and growing up in sort of this ramshackle family home with multiple generations kind of living together. It's set in the mid late 70s for the initial part. It's kind of told in two. You have the protagonist as a young man, just as a boy, and then as a college student, and so you have these sort of divergent storylines, but they're all sort of revolving around this idea of. You know, place of where you're from, you know, what that means, you know, what it means to be a man, particularly when you don't have necessarily all the right models for manhood in your life. It's, you know, so the young man, JR, the boy is played by a kid named Daniel Ranieri, who's great.
Yeah.
I think this is his sort of debut. Like he's sort of a discovery made by the filmmaker. You may have heard of him, a fellow by the name of George Clooney.
Oh, yes, I remember him. From St. Elsewhere.
Yes, he was, I believe he was Roseanne's foreman on Roseanne, if you remember. So it's J.R., his mom, single mom, Dorothy, played by Lily Rabe, returned to Long Island because the boy's dad, a ubiquitous sort of radio DJ known only as The Voice, who he shows up later. He's played by Max Martini. He's suitably gross. So they move back in with his mom's parents.
So the radio guy's a deadbeat? Man, who saw that coming?
I know. In the 70s?
Wow.
But they move back into the house with her parents, you know, the boy's grandparents, grandpa, played just magnificently by Christopher Lloyd.
Yeah.
Like I didn't even know he was in this movie when I sat down to watch it, but like he, like the sort of the brilliant but sort of coming unglued sort of patriarch of the whole family.
The scene in the car after he takes the boy to the father-son breakfast, it's just beautiful.
Yeah. Well, and it's just, I mean, and it's one of those things where it's just a reminder of how important it can be to have, you know, to have these kinds of pros in these kinds of parts, you know, because it's not a big part. It's not a particularly flashy part, but it's for scenes like that, exactly what you're talking about, that you want someone like Christopher Lloyd in the picture. But look, here's the thing, like, and this is what everyone should be talking about as far as this movie is concerned. JR connects most deeply with his Uncle Charlie, his mom's brother, played just magnificently by Ben Affleck. Like, it's one of those things where I hope he's so good here. I hope this is the direction he continues to go in. Like, you've done the movie star thing, Ben, like, and you're good at it. But when you're like, when he's doing stuff like this, he's this wonderfully underachieving intellectual, sort of an autodidact who's self-taught, but just like reads constantly, runs a literary bar called the Dickens.
And you'll appreciate this. I said to myself, if this were a stage play, I want to see Alan Adams playing Uncle Charlie.
Oh, listen to you. Listen to you. That's fantastic. That's very touching. But yeah, so but so Uncle Charlie kind of takes the boy under his wing and spends a lot of time teaching him, you know, sort of how to be a person, how to, you know, because he, you know, his mom's working all the time. And the big thing for his mom is she's like, you're going to the Ivy League and you're going to be a lawyer. Like, that's what's going to happen. And with the support of all these people surrounding him, like, he gets there. He gets to Yale, you know, in the, I believe in 1982 is when he starts. The now grown boy, played by Ty Sheridan, who, you know, has to deal with a whole different kind of education, not just academic, but social, when he goes to Yale. Because he's a, you know, he's a poor kid from Long Island, you know, surrounded by the assorted silver spoons, including one, a young lady who, man, doesn't she string him along, like, just in an infuriating fashion. You know, it's one of those things where it's like, I don't even want to say her name. I don't even want to say her name because she treats my boy JR so poorly. You know, he goes to school, still on the lawyer track, but what he really wants to do, largely because of Uncle Charlie's influence, is become a writer. And wouldn't you know it, that's kind of the direction in which he winds up going. But even as he's grown and he's a college student, he still finds his way back to Long Island and still finds his way back to the bar where he sits and takes in the hard-earned wisdom of not just Uncle Charlie, but just a fantastic assortment of just... You don't want to call them barflies because that's sort of derogatory, but they're definitely barflies.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
You know, it's
and they're
like,
great. Max Casella.
Like, I love me some Max Casella.
You bet.
A gentleman by the name of Matt Delimiter.
Who's coming on with us on Thursday.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah, because he's he lives in Southern Maine.
Yep.
And he's sort of a late to the game sort of actor. He's done a lot. I know he's done a lot of theater stuff down there, but now he's really starting to get a lot of work. Especially since Boston has become more and more of a movie making hub, which. Just in on the nitpicking side, there are a couple of scenes where we're outside and they're telling us that we're in New York City, and it's like, come on, like,
well, including the candlepin bowling scene, like, maybe they have that in New York, but I don't think so.
It's, yeah, you know, it's just like, yeah, Wakefield candlepin, you're gonna tell me that's on Long Island?
Yeah,
is that what you're telling me?
Right.
But you know, I mean, that's just a minor thing, but you know, the performances are really good. We mentioned Christopher Lloyd. I actually think the boy is a little better than Ty Sheridan. Like,
yeah, he's a little bit undercooked there.
And, you know, and he's fine. Like, he's a talented kid, but it's just, if for whatever reason, I think it's just because there's something so open about the little boy, especially in his connection with Lily Rabe, who's playing his mom, and of course Affleck, that, you know, you just lose a little bit of that. Just because, you know, this is, I mean, it's an untrained kid. Like, there's nothing in the way of him engaging in an honest manner.
Unencumbered by training.
But ultimately, the conversation around this movie, and as well it should, is going to revolve around Ben Affleck's performance. Because, like we said, like, it's just, he's so good and so honest. And it's almost like a, I don't know, like a mirror version of the dude he plays in Good Will Hunting. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like this sort of inverse, like a very thoughtful and sensitive and very, very smart guy who, for whatever reason, we never really find out why, but never really left. Like, you know, just,
and I read an interview with Affleck yesterday, and he was explaining that he understood the role because his parents broke up when he was a kid. And his dad, I think, owned a bar. And when he was with his dad, he was the little kid. He would sit at the bar and take in the wisdom of dad and the patrons.
Yeah, and it's one of those things where it's just like, and you can feel that, you know what I mean? Like, it's just like there's something very, very truthful about his performance. And, you know, and the reality is, like, we all know that guy.
Yeah,
like,
yeah,
we've all like had that guy in our lives, whether it's a, you know, it's a drinking buddy or an uncle or what have you. Like, that person exists in the world, and for Affleck to so thoroughly just embrace that, and it's a good movie. When he's on screen, it's a great movie.
Yeah,
like, that's kind of where I come down on it. And, you know, and good for Clooney. This is a really a bit of a departure from his last directorial outing, like The Midnight Sky, which I liked more than most.
I did too.
But but it's nice to see him sort of pivot to this more intimate kind of storytelling. And he's someone too who I think he's sort of getting back into the swing of things as far as like wanting to do things and wanting to make things. And hopefully like this is the path he continues to pursue. But yeah, The Tender Bar, it's available on Amazon Prime right now. It's just a lovely sort of coming of age story. And if you're into that sort of thing, you should really check it out.
Awesome. Yeah, I loved it. I loved it. I agree with everything you said, but I usually do. Because you know, you're Alan.
I'm very smart about these things.
what did you? Is there another movie you've seen in the last couple of weeks that?
Would
have talked about if you'd been here.
There's one I would very much like to talk about. I went down. Sheridan and I actually. This was the weekend. This was right before Christmas. I think it was either the week before Christmas or the week after Christmas. I don't remember exactly. But we went down to Waterville. To Railroad Square, where they are, as of right now, still screening Licorice Pizza.
Oh, man.
Man, wasn't that a good movie? I'm pretty ride or die for Paul Thomas Anderson anyway. But for him to sort of make this move back to this particular time, the 1970s, that he clearly has an affinity for, to this particular place, the San Fernando Valley, which is where he grew up. He has a very strong connection to there. And to tell a much less sordid story than the last time we spent time in the San Fernando Valley with Paul Thomas Anderson. No porn stars in this one.
No.
The synopsis, such as it is, it's basically you've got a young man named Gary Valentine, played by Cooper Hoffman, the son of the late Philip Seymour Hoffman, which, by the way... Looks enough like his dad for it to be familiar, but not so much to be distracting. It's great. But yeah, he's 15 years old. He's in high school. He's a child actor, had a couple solid credits, but starting to age out of the stuff that he's been doing. He's at his high school picture day, when he meets a girl named Alana, played by Alana Haim of the band Haim. She's 10 years his senior. She's the photographer's assistant. And he just shoots a shot, basically dares her to come to dinner, to meet him at this bar around the corner from his house for dinner. She shows up, and their relationship sort of starts to develop in a odd kind of way. At one point, she serves as his chaperone to go to New York City because his mom is busy. So he does this TV appearance to promote a movie. Starring a Lucille Ball analog, that's a hilarious scene. They just sort of, like, Gary's a hustler, so he comes up with all these business ideas. Alana's kind of drifting through her early adulthood, not really sure what she wants to do, and so she finds herself sort of drawn in by, Gary's just pure ambition, like charm and ambition. Like, that's just what he brings to the table. And so, their relationship is obviously fraught. It's complicated. Both of them sort of pursue other romantic interests, but that they inevitably return to one another. Gary starts some businesses. She starts working for the Joel Wax mayoral campaign. They just sort of keep connecting, drifting apart, connecting, drifting apart as the sort of time progresses. And that's kind of it. Like, it's a very shaggy movie. Like, not a lot really happens. But it's such a good hang. Like, the vibe is so interesting that you can't help but be swept along, and you're just so enamored of both of these characters for very different reasons. I mentioned Hoffman. He's got some of that it that his dad had. He's still relatively inexperienced, but I think that's more of a feature than a bug, because Alana Haim, also not necessarily a seasoned actor. I mean, a gifted performer,
right?
And so they both have these not sort of adjacent, acting adjacent sort of experiences that allow for a more of a natural connection between the two. That's really wonderful to enjoy. And then, there are some supporting turns in this film with actors playing both real people and sort of analogs of real people. Bradley Cooper shows up as John Peters for a couple of scenes.
Which is just the little bit that's in the trailer is great.
He's spectacular. and just going for it in just the absolute best way. Benny Safdie of the Safdie Brothers, he plays Joel Wax, the mayoral candidate with whom Alana volunteers. Those are both real people, you know what I mean? But we also have sort of these analogs. There's an actor named Jack Holden, who is very clearly intended to be William Holden, played with just exquisite sleaziness by Sean Penn.
Oh, man.
We get an audition scene between, because Alana wants to be an actress, and so there's an audition scene there. He takes her out to dinner afterwards, and they're at the restaurant, and a director, a friend of Jack Holden, shows up. Wouldn't you know it, it's Tom Waits.
Oh, man.
And basically, it feels like Anderson was just like, you know what? Like, I'm just going to turn on some cameras, and we're just going to shoot these two being weirdos for like 5 minutes and see what happens. And it's just phenomenal. That stuff is great. The vibe is so wonderful. He's so good at evoking like period settings like that. So everything looks great. The music is beautifully curated, just a fantastic, soundtrack top to bottom, with a score by, Johnny Greenwood. Just so good. There are a couple of issues. I mean, there's the sort of elephant in the room ickiness of the central relationship dynamic. A thing that, there's no spoiler, but I will say it's a problem that could be greatly curtailed simply by ending the movie like 3 minutes earlier.
Mm.
That's all I'm going to say. You'll figure it out when you see it. And there's an unfortunate running bit with John Michael Higgins, where he is the owner of a Japanese restaurant. He has an Asian wife, and whenever he speaks to her, it's in that weird broken English.
Mm.
And I just don't understand why it's there. And it's so jarring. And I get it. Like, it was a different time and people behaved in different ways, but it just seems a little much.
Mm.
But I mean, those are just, you know, we're talking about a total of, you know, 4 minutes
right.
out of a 2 hour plus film. That's just masterful. Like, I'm not going to put this in the top tier of PTA movies. But I mean, the reality is like, man, middle tier PTA is better than, well, it's, I mean, one of the best movies I saw this year, you know.
They had the Golden Globes. Nobody was there. It wasn't on TV. should we take anything from it other than that? Maybe was it Power of the Dog is going to do pretty well in the Oscars?
I think Power of the Dog. I think we already knew Power of the Dog was going to do really well. I think, if anything, the Academy is probably more inclined to want to give Jane Campion some recognition because it's been so long since we've seen anything from her. That movie is beautiful. I think it will be a very serious contender in categories across the board. A couple of surprises. Like, I would have been more inclined to think Cumberbatch would win for Best Actor than Cody Smith McPhee for Supporting Actor. But Smith McPhee won, and Will Smith actually won for Best Actor in the dramatic category, which is fine. Like, he was wonderful in King Richard, so that makes sense. West Side Story did pretty well. Musicals as a rule tend to do pretty well at the Golden Globes. The young lady, both of the young ladies, the young lady who played Maria and Anita, they both won awards for their performances, and West Side Story was best picture, comedy or musical. I don't know if it means anything. It's so hard to tell. It would have been nice to have the sort of counterpoint of the Critics' Choice Awards,
right?
Which were initially scheduled to take place last night as well, but they were doing an actual ceremony. And so with the circumstances being what they are, they delayed and pushed that ceremony back. I think the Critics' Choice is probably going to be a bit more of an accurate precursor to the Academy Awards. But ultimately, like, nobody really knows. And the truth is, because of how strange and staggered these film releases have been, like, it's just difficult to know. Like, it's just hard for people to see everything.
Yeah.
I know people get screeners and whatnot, but it's the screenings, I think, where a lot of these decisions are made. And, you know, when you have fewer of those, you have fewer people, you know, going and seeing. And are they going to, you know, click the link or put in the DVD or what have you at home? I don't know.
Right.
And so it just, it'll be interesting to see if, if it's sort of the same roster of films that we've been seeing so far, Power of the Dog, Belfast, West Side Story, et cetera, or if some more interesting sort of, X factors come in. I know the Japanese film Drive My Car is receiving a ton of positive press, but is a 3-hour Japanese movie going to win Best Picture at the Oscars? Like, that seems unlikely to me. Not because of any sort of quality issue with the film, just because, I mean, I've watched the Oscars. Like, I know how this tends to go. And, you know, and who knows? Maybe we get a crowd-pleasing choice in there. I think Dune's probably going to get picked, but I know. But, man, Spider-Man's running. We'll see how it goes, but exactly. They're running. It's so up in the air, and we're still, 2.5 months away from the Oscars? Like,
exactly.
You know, they're late March, so a lot could change between now and then.
All right. Al, good to see you. Nice to have you back with us.
Nice to see you as well, man.
Let's do it Wednesday.
Yes, let's.
And we'll talk about what Stella has done to you again.
Oh, my God. You know, it's like, I'm past the point of being embarrassed.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's like, 7 out of 9 times, you know, it's like at a certain point, you just have to accept the reality of what's happening to you.
Dog beats man yet again.
Indeed.
All right. Thanks, Al. We'll see you Wednesday.
Yes, sir.
Alan Adams of the Main Edge talking.